Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, City Council hears from CMPD about the many Safe Charlotte programs in place, but some on council want a more aggressive approach. Council also meets with the Mecklenburg delegation to the General Assembly to encourage their support for our transit plan. Efforts by Republican Judge Jefferson Griffin to toss votes out of the count for a seat on the state Supreme Court is getting national attention. There's also a battle over which court system will decide. In response to the number of virus cases in our midst, hospital systems limit visitors, and our state may be in for some wildfires of its own. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE climate reporter Zachary Turner. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV. Mary Ramsey is the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Ryan Pitkin is founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Thank you all for being here. Good morning.
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 And a sudden silence falls over the room. This past Monday, Charlotte City Council held its first full business meeting of the year, and they began with the review of CMPD's Safe Charlotte program. Ryan, remind us what the Safe Charlotte program is.
So the Safe Charlotte program is sort of an umbrella that it was launched in the wake of the George Floyd protests and also in response to rising gun violence that was happening in 2020 and the years leading up to it. It has to do with a lot of different programming, some from CMPD. A lot of it has to do with the city allocating $1 million annually to go towards grassroots organizations outside of the police department that work on youth mentorship, anti-violence, things like that. And this was sort of our first, I wouldn't say our first, but definitely our first in a long time, real long-term review of what has come out of this, what Chief Johnny Jennings could really point to that Safe Charlotte has accomplished over the last 5 years, 4 years.
And he got some pushback on that, which we'll talk about in a second. But one of the things that he also talked about was shifting low-risk traffic accident investigation to new civilian investigators. This has been going on for a while, right?
No, this actually just launched in December. The Community Policing Crisis Response Team. The Crisis Response Team has been going on for a while, but the actual Civilian Crash Investigations Unit was just launched in December. You've already taken 5,000 calls, though, apparently.
So is that an attempt to de-escalate any potential pushback from motorists who are stopped by officers because they're not officers, they're not gun-carrying officers, or is it because they're trying to use the officers in a more effective way and keep costs down?
I think that depends on who you talk to. If they're talking to community advocates who are looking for police reform, they say this will reduce the interactions between people and gun and sworn officers with guns. If you talk to CMPD, that says this opens up more time for our officers.
And this is accident response. So if you call 911 because you've been involved in an accident, they send somebody out. Do they always send these civilian response teams out now, or is it on a case-by-case basis? And if so, how do they decide who to send?
Yeah, it's only for accidents that are no injuries involved, stuff like, you know, you have to pull off to the shoulder. I messed up earlier. I was getting this messed up with the crisis response team. They have responded to 500 calls, not 5,000, and filed 300 crash reports, but it's always going to be just the low priority sort of no injury calls, not a lot of high damage. So folks can sort of get out of the way of traffic and things like that.
Those community policing crisis response teams pair a clinician with an officer to respond to mental health and homelessness calls. And Johnny Jennings also talked about those teams having over 700 interactions and responding to about 680 calls for service. Are those efforts having their intended impact?
It would seem so. I mean, they are being effective in the sense of, they spoke a good bit about these teams have diverted 77 people from jail. Tijuana Brown asked what that means later on, and Jennings explained that that just sort of means if someone has committed a crime in the midst of a mental health episode and one of these crisis teams responds, they have a actual clinician with them who can recognize what's going on and, you know, or suggest help somewhere else other than just putting them in jail, locking them up, and that's not really going to put an end to the root problem.
So Johnny Jennings spent a lot of time talking about these so-called soft responses or changes in policing that maybe de-escalate things and stretch the force out a little bit more, but it's all part of the Safe Charlotte Initiative, and Republican Councilman Ed Driggs pushed back a little bit because we're having this rise in homicides in Charlotte, and he was wondering if these programs actually work.
We have been talking about sort of dramatic initiatives, Safe Charlotte and so on, for 4 years at least, and we can't point to, big success.
Did Johnny Jennings have a response to that?
Yeah, Jennings was, he was quick to point out that homicides don't paint the whole picture of crime in Charlotte. I always make sure to, a few days after this is when CMPD released its end of year report and gave the full stats. I always think it's important to mention that year to year data, if you're just talking about the previous year, does not necessarily constitute a trend. But I mean, Ed Driggs is also correct in the sense that, we saw a rise in violent crime victimization. We saw a large rise in homicides, 25%. So Jennings was just sort of saying, take it all in at the end of year report. He's going to be coming back in front of council on February 10th to actually speak specifically about violent crime. It seems like the council members have been itching to get to that topic through all of his previous reports. He's been coming in front of them monthly. So that'll be when they really have the deep talk about this.
Well, yesterday, the CMPD, this is after the council meeting on Monday, yesterday, CMPD released their end of year crime report. You already mentioned one of the things that they talked about, that homicides are up 25%. What else did that report reveal?
So it's a lot of, they're throwing a lot of little single digit numbers at you here at the top of it. There was a 3% drop in overall crime, yet there was a 3% increase in violent crime. And then you go deeper into the violent crime reports, and that's a 3% increase in violent crime victimization, but a 1% drop in incidents, meaning there's just, I guess, more incidents in which more people are victimized. Say if you're shooting into a residence that's full of people, then every one of those persons is a victim. So there's a little bit of an increase there in the violent crime, how many people are affected by violent crime in our city.
And when you look at the homicide rate on a graph, if you were to plot it out on a graph, it kind of looks like the stock market. It has ups and downs and ups and downs like a roller coaster. But overall, the trend, if I'm not mistaken, is up. You also report that at this week's council meeting, council was generally supportive of CMPD Chief Jennings and his department's efforts to reimagine public safety. But there were some on council, including Dimple Ashmira, who suggested that the city needs to set concrete goals for reducing homicides from the 110 killings that we experienced last year, which was up from the year before. Did she get a response to that?
No, I think that conversation will definitely happen in a more in-depth way in the February meeting, but there are, there was some deflection there from Jennings. He drew comparisons to other cities around our size. Baltimore specifically has seen success lately in reducing their number, but he also pointed out that their number is so much higher than ours to start with that what they reduce to is something we don't want to see. So he was just sort of using that as an example to say, well, our city's actually, doing really well compared to others. But he didn't really address the key issues of the fact that it's gone up.
City Council also approved funding for a pedestrian bridge over I-277, Mary, to connect South End to Uptown on the rail trail. How much is this going to cost?
So the contract that was approved this week is for a little over $16.5 million. This project was originally slated to cost about $11 million when it first came up back in 2019. Been delayed a couple times, was originally scheduled to open in 2023, then pushed to spring 2025. Now, according to the latest information, we're looking at a mid-2028 opening for this bridge.
So is that additional $5 million in costs because we've waited from 2019 to 2025 and costs have increased?
That's what it's been attributed to, yeah, and that's been one of the holdups on this project, rising costs as well as redesigns and other administrative delays.
And initially, I think we paid $1.6 million to design that bridge. It looks pretty fancy schmancy when you look at the renderings of it. Where will the money to build this come from?
Few different sources. There's some city and county money in there, as well as some state Department of Transportation money and some private donations.
You said the magic word, transit, transportation. Let's talk about that because the transit plan was also on City Council's agenda on Monday night. For years now, we have had a transit plan. That's all pretty much it's been, a transit plan. And we've known that we will need federal and state money to fund it. And last year, without a plan, as a way or a plan for a way to fund it being approved, the city bought the tracks from Norfolk Southern for the Red Line to Mooresville. And finally, on Monday, City Council met with state lawmakers who represent Mecklenburg County in Raleigh to urge their support for our transit goals. The legislature has to say okay to allowing us to put a sales tax for transit on the November ballot. And Ed McKinney, who works with the city of Charlotte, made the somewhat obvious point that we can't execute that plan without the money.
Having money on the table is really an important part of the public conversation. We cannot continue to just simply think about our plans in absence of a way to fund them.
Okay, Joe, we've been talking about this and we've been on this program for a decade, it seems. Why did council need that reminder from Ed McKinney that we need to have money?
Yeah, it feels like we've been talking about it as long as we've been planning that dang bridge. The money, I think it's a good reminder of Charlotte's position in all of this, where we can have all these great plans, but we can't do anything without the money, which we can't get without a referendum, which we can't have without the permission of the General Assembly. And, you know, I was at the state delegation meeting last year. They kind of danced around the sales tax topic. This year, that was the entire conversation.
We modified our transit plan, as everybody knows, over the last year in response to criticism from legislative leaders about our plan being too train-centric and not focused on roads and other less technological forms of transportation. Do we have any idea how the Mecklenburg delegation responded to that and to our presentation to them when they met with council members this week?
I was expecting to hear more about Matthew's opposition to the plans since three representatives of the town of Matthews were in the room with them, but none of that came up. It was all, we're on the same team. I think those conversations are happening. They're just in private. Councilmember Dimple Ejmyra kind of alluded to that, but she also made sure to point out like the exact configurations of these lines haven't been finalized, and the MTC and the future governing board will ultimately have the final say.
And I've been saying for years the clock is ticking on all of this, and it truly is ticking because the most transit-oriented administration, probably in recent history, is about to leave office in 4 days. And we have to get this thing on the ballot by November, which means it has to be voted on in the legislature, probably in the first quarter. And Mary, you reported that the lone Republicans in the Mecklenburg County legislative delegation, State Senator Vicky Sawyer and Representative Tricia Cotham, are going to play critical roles in convincing Republicans in the General Assembly, which they dominate, to get on board. I have 30 seconds. Are they, those two, on board?
They appear to be. Sawyer is taking a leadership role in the state Senate on this, and she announced at that legislative briefing that Cotham will be taking on some leadership in the House alongside Democratic State Rep Becky Carney.
Going to come back, talk a little bit more about that and also Stein's recent executive order, I think from yesterday, Josh Stein, our new governor, regarding abortions. We'll get to that in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Zachary Turner's with us. He's our climate reporter for WFAE News. Ryan Pitkin is founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Joe Bruno, reports for WSOC TV. We mentioned a second ago, Mary, that both State Senator Vicki Sawyer and Representative Tricia Cottom in the Mecklenburg County delegation to the General Assembly will be kind of the point people on convincing fellow Republicans there to vote with us for a referendum, a sales tax referendum on the November ballot. And you also reported that Senator Sawyer, who chairs the Senate's powerful Transportation Committee, believes that the bill has a 50-50 chance of passing in time to make it onto that November ballot. Councilman Malcolm Graham, who is also a former member of the legislature, has said that Raleigh would have to move on this in the first quarter of 2025. Well, we're in that quarter. He's also said we have no plan B. Will that reality play any role in motivating the General Assembly to move quickly on this?
We asked Sawyer about that timeline, and she said that the city is putting on pressure to move quickly, but that the General Assembly often does not act quickly, and at the end of the day, it's in their control. So again, plays into exactly what she said about this being a jump ball at this point. She acknowledged there's a lot of new legislators coming in, got to figure out where they stand on these things, and really reiterating her longstanding opinion on this issue, which is that her community, North Mecklenburg and Iredell County, could really benefit from the red line, but that it's hard for a Republican-dominated legislature to swallow a tax cut, and that remains a hurdle.
You mean a tax increase?
A tax increase, yes.
Yeah. Joe?
And I don't think that the legislature wants to be asked about this all year either. I think that Charlotte will probably get an answer by the end of spring. I don't know if it will be the answer the city wants. That's going to have a lot of work still has to happen.
So if approved, both the legislature have to say yes to the referendum, and then voters have to say yes at the ballot box on the 1 cent sales tax increase that would generate more than $19 billion over 30 years. And that money would then be divided among the towns in Mecklenburg County. Ed McKinney leads strategic mobility for the city of Charlotte, and he stresses that they are modeling this plan after that in other cities.
We've talked with the city of Phoenix, we've talked with the city of Nashville, Columbus, all three of which had successful sales tax referendums just this past fall. They have all taken this approach. It gives us a path forward and certainly some lessons to learn as we move forward with this effort.
Again, we have been talking about this sales tax referendum for nearly a decade. How does what happened in those cities play into this?
I think what happened in others, those are examples of communities that have rallied to support the measure when presented the opportunity to do so. And kind of like what I've been saying for, you know, the past half decade we've been talking about this, I think the easiest part for Charlotte will be convincing voters to support it, especially if all the business support there is for this measure and all of the ads and the groups that will be formed and the campaigns. It's just going to be tough to get to that spot.
So Ed McKinney said that should the referendum be approved in Raleigh and passed by the voters, the red line train to Mooresville would be the first priority. So we'll see what happens. Governor Josh Stein has been very busy in the first few weeks in office issuing executive orders. The first six were focused on Hurricane Helene relief. And yesterday he issued an order which orders state agencies not to cooperate with investigations into medical professionals who provide legal abortions. Mary, what prompted this?
Yes, so this is an extension and expansion of an executive order issued by former Governor Roy Cooper back in 2022 after the Dobbs decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. Reiterates some of the policies laid out in that order, including ordering state agencies to not mandate pregnant employees travel for work to states that have imposed restrictions on reproductive health care. It also, as you mentioned, calls for state agencies to not cooperate if another state is looking into a doctor or individual who came to North Carolina to perform or receive an abortion. The order also ordered state law enforcement agencies to not arrest someone who is wanted in another state for getting or providing reproductive health care in North Carolina that's legal in North Carolina.
And that includes State Highway Patrol, alcohol law enforcement, and State Capitol Police. They have been restricted from arresting folks who may be charged in another state with providing or seeking an abortion. This sounds like Nazi Germany to me, the fact that this is going on. I swear to God, it's outrageous. Okay, moving on. After more than 11 years as Duke Energy CEO and chair, Lynn Good announced that she will retire effective April the 1st. And aside from her being one of the few female CEOs of major companies and her being considered among the world's most powerful women in business, Zach, what will this mean for Duke Energy?
I mean, this is, I guess, a big shift for the company in the sense that Lynn Good has been with Duke Energy for nearly 20 years. But at the same time, I don't know that it's necessarily going to be a huge shift in how Duke Energy operates. She's being replaced by Harry Sideris, who's been with the company about 30 years now. He worked with Progress Energy before it was even acquired by Duke Energy. So in a way, he's going to be inheriting a lot of the same problems that Lynn Good was facing towards the end of her tenure as CEO of Duke Energy. And that's going to include the fact that Duke Energy is one of the top three emitters of carbon dioxide in this country and was recently sued by the town of Carrboro for casting doubt on climate change in order to avoid stricter regulations. These are still going to be things that Duke Energy is going to have to deal with moving forward.
And yet during her tenure, and correct me if I'm wrong, Lynn Good has been credited for her innovation and her efforts to reduce the company's carbon emissions. What's your, you cover climate change and you cover the environment.
I guess it depends on who you ask.
What's your assessment?
Yeah, I think in a large part, like what Duke Energy does is going to really depend on initiatives from the state. That's going to be, you know, a lot of decision making based on collaboration with stakeholders like environmental groups, clean energy advocates, businesses in the area, and also just state policy. North Carolina has this goal of reaching carbon neutrality by 2050. They have this interim target of reaching a 70% reduction in carbon emissions by 2030. And so it really depends state by state how hard the Duke Energy is kind of being pushed to meet some of these goals. You see this like with Florida, where they have a much lower like residential efficiency rate than in North Carolina, where, you know, maybe that has been prioritized a little bit more. And you can see that Duke Energy is like what they're doing kind of varies state by state. It's not necessarily like uniform across the entire company.
During her tenure at the top of the heap at Duke Energy, the company acquired other companies, including Piedmont Natural Gas. And speaking of which, natural gas futures, that's the price of the people predicting the price of gas going forward, soared at the end of the year. What does that mean for consumers?
So that is interesting. This got on my radar because we had a weird thing where we aired a marketplace story on our station that was saying natural gas prices were going up. And then right after that, we had our own report that Duke Energy was lowering their electrical rates due to fuel costs going down. As I wanted to kind of do a little bit of an explainer here to let people know, like, yes, these two things can happen just based on the way that our rates are structured. This is like, you know, fuel costs are passed directly onto the consumer, right, but it's not like in real time. There are some things that Piedmont Natural Gas does to hedge that a little bit.
Well, there are Piedmont Natural Gas customers, I'm one of them, who have gas heat. And then there are Duke Energy customers, and they generate electricity in some ways with natural gas. Did they get a better deal on natural gas?
No, because their rates are going down. So this is something that they're doing. You know, Piedmont Natural Gas and Duke Energy, they're both establishing these rates in collaboration with the Utilities Commission. And so the way that this works is that for Piedmont Natural Gas, they're doing a projection of how much fuel is going to cost them in the future. And then as time goes on, as their projections shift, they go to the Utilities Commission. They say, all right, we got to, you know, modify this a little bit so that this is accurate and we're not losing money or we're not taking in too much money based on fuel rates alone. And there's a lot of other stuff that's baked into this. They're also, you know, recovering costs on new infrastructure. They're also changing the amount of revenue that they're generating on these rates. And so all of that goes into your, you know, gas heating rate. And that's not necessarily something that's going to be reflective of natural gas prices at that exact moment, because these rates are set well in advance.
Okay. Another week, another reason to talk about the Riggs-Griffin election. When last we left our intrepid heroes, incumbent state Supreme Court Justice Allison Riggs, the Democrat, was leading her Republican challenger, Judge Jefferson Griffin, by 734 votes after several bipartisan recounts. But Riggs and the state GOP were engaged in trying to get 60,000 votes, if you recall, thrown out. Well, now they're sparring over which court should decide the ultimate outcome of all of that. Ryan, fill us in. Unmute yourself. Ryan, sorry, unmute yourself.
Unmuted,
there you go.
Unmuted. Yeah, Joe might be better at me than about which court is handling this right now. Okay. But I will say that this week, Jefferson sort of changed his tone and his plot in terms of what votes he's trying to challenge. He's now gone down to the 5,000 or so, or 5,500 ballots cast by military members overseas that were not, did not have to use a photo ID to do so, even though it's state law, they don't have to. And they've been sort of batting back and forth between the Fourth Circuit, requesting the NC Supreme Court to take it over. I think it's in the Fourth Circuit now. Is that right, Joe? Who's going to decide whether it's federally challenged or in the state?
Yeah, it's in the Court of Appeals. It's also at the state Supreme Court. But both camps are hiring attorneys, and it seems like they're preparing for the U.S. Supreme Court to have a say in this.
So just to be clear, the state Supreme Court put a stay on the Board of Elections certifying this election, even though after several recounts, Riggs remains ahead. And she's an incumbent on the court. She remains ahead 734 votes. And so they took it to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals to consider. If the Court of Appeals says you can proceed, that Allison Riggs is the winner, I'm assuming, Joe, that that will likely be appealed by the Griffin campaign. And if they say Griffin is the winner, will that not likely be appealed by the Riggs campaign?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's precisely why the U.S. Supreme Court will likely have to weigh in some way.
And if they decide to let the state court decide on this, the state court is controlled by the Republicans. I think it can be successfully argued that the state Supreme Court has become increasingly partisan over recent years. So if it goes back to them, are they likely just to say, we're done with this? Griffin, you win. You're the Republican.
I don't know. So yes, the state Supreme Court is increasingly partisan. However, if you read the opinions from when they said they will consider the appeal, Judge Richard Dietz had a very fierce dissent. And Judge Trey Allen, and he's a Republican.
Yeah,
he's a Republican. And then Judge Trey Allen, also a Republican, his what he wrote was like, hey, just because we're allowing these arguments to move forward doesn't mean that I am on board with what he is saying.
This, although it's local or statewide, this is an important moment in court and political history. And it's just now getting national attention from the press and from the National Democratic Party. Former Governor Roy Cooper was on a call this week with state and national Democratic leaders, during which he called this an example of Republicans going to an extreme to try to take this seat on the high court.
We know that Republicans have politicized the courts to a major extreme here by just seeing what they did.
And National Democratic Party Chair Jamie Harrison has related this attempt to disqualify 60,000 votes to try to win an election that multiple recounts have demonstrated the Republican candidate lost to what happened in the presidential election of 2020, when Donald Trump insisted and continues to insist that it was stolen from him, though it clearly was not. Meanwhile, the state GOP and Judge Griffin as you mentioned, Ryan, have narrowed their focus from that 60,000 votes, calling now for the removal of 5,509 votes from the count, which they say were unlawfully cast. Of those, 46.1% are registered unaffiliated voters, 43.8% are Democrats, and what do you know, 9.3% are Republicans. So how and why did they target those ballots, those voters?
They're targeting the early voters and the mail voters. They're not targeting the election day voters. If you include the election day voters, you're going to get a significant more amount of Republicans included in that total. It's a cherry-picked selection of ballots that they are trying to have tossed out of this race. If you are a Democrat, I believe Democrats might outnumber Republicans 5 times. I think Brian Anderson did an analysis of this, friend of the show. It's a very cherry-picked data, and I don't think we've seen anything like this. And it's a blueprint too. If this is successful, I'm sure this will be a blueprint across the country in close races.
This disinclination to concede elections that would previously have been conceded, and then finding new and novel ways to take issue with the validity of votes, certainly threatens to shake voters' confidence in our elections, which some believe is the purpose of this. And Governor Cooper sees another threat to norms.
I'm deeply concerned that this will further politicize our courts and cause people to lose confidence in them, particularly if they know cases are already decided, depending on what the political party is who brought the lawsuit or is defending the lawsuit.
Couldn't it be successfully argued that that has already happened?
I think so. And the problem here is that it sets a blueprint, as Joe said, for a future plan. When anytime somebody loses in a statewide election, or who knows, federal, whatever, this could have been a wider plan, but North Carolina Republicans have been trying to do it since before the election. But it sets a precedent for folks to look back and try to retroactively enforce election registration laws that weren't even in effect. So they're challenging ballots and election registration that happened years and years ago. Everybody would have to basically re-register to make sure that they're fine.
This is flying over a lot of people's heads, and I suppose it shouldn't, because it's dangerous. How concerned should we be? How concerned do you think the average person is about this? Not at all, because they're not paying attention?
I think there's some concern. I feel bad for a lot of these people who voted because they feel powerless right now. They're helpless. They don't know what to do. They did nothing wrong. And now their vote is potentially in limbo.
And we will spend an hour on this topic on Thursday of next week on Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Joe Bruno's here from WSOC-TV. Ryan Pitkin, founder, editor of Queen City Nerve. Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Zach Turner is our climate reporter here at WFAE News. And Zach, we spent some time earlier this week on this program talking about viruses that become part of our lives each year about this time. And state health officials are seeing an uptick in respiratory illnesses like flu, RSV, and COVID. One way they measure this is through checking virus levels in wastewater, and the latest numbers on that were released the day after we did that program on viruses. What do those numbers show?
Yeah, so I mean, anyone can pull up the North Carolina Department of Health Services dashboard on this, and they can kind of see how we're doing in terms of these respiratory infections. And right now, looking at the week ending on January 11th, it looks like we're at about, you know, I think we're starting to see a little bit of a decrease in these cases. But yeah, flu and COVID-19 are pretty closely, and the other respiratory viruses RSV, they are kind of closely mirroring each other here.
I mean, if people thought that COVID was gone, they'd be wrong. It's merely been tamed. No. The highest number of respiratory illnesses, according to those numbers released earlier this week, is due to flu. The lowest is due to RSV. But COVID is right there, smack dab in the middle. It comes in at number two. But the number of emergency room visits and hospitalizations from these viruses was down this week as compared to the week before, but that has not stopped hospital systems like Atrium and Novant and others across the state from restricting visitor access. What should we take from that?
Yeah, I mean, and one of the precautions that they're advising for folks here, in addition to not, Atrium said, put in this restriction that children under 12 should not be making visits to acute care hospitals. Iredell Memorial Hospital followed suit the day after, putting this restriction on, this is starting Wednesday, that children under the age of 14 will not be allowed to visit parents or relatives in the hospital. In order to limit the spread here. But they're also saying, you know, just mask up, keep some of the same precautions that we had right at the beginning of the pandemic. And that applies anytime that you're seeing a spike in these respiratory infections.
And Dr. Christopher Ohl is an infectious disease expert from Atrium Health at Wake Forest Baptist in Winston-Salem. He says the cases are high, though not out of the ordinary for this time of year.
It's keeping our emergency rooms busy. It's keeping our hospitals busy. Not anything that can't be handled in the region, but every year during respiratory viral season, we have more admissions, and this year is no different than usual.
He added that flu cases are at their highest level at any time since the pandemic. Are they just doing this out of an abundance of caution, these restrictions now? If the rates are falling, is that why they're doing this?
No, I mean, it's like you said, it's not an out of the usual. If you look at some of these charts showing over time, like last year, we had a big spike over the winter of influenza and other respiratory illnesses. And even though things are going down, it's going down because we're taking these precautions and being careful.
We all know that the cost of living has been challenging for individuals and for organizations trying to recruit and retain workers. And this week, Charlotte-Mecklenburg school administrators asked the Board of Education to raise the pay rates for hourly support staff. This comes after a third-party consultant's compensation study.
Employees shared concerns that they were not compensated appropriately, and the method to calculate their compensation was unclear. This resulted in multiple requests for individual compensation reviews.
CMS Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill, how much are administrators asking for, Zach? Zach, unmute yourself, please.
I'm on it, sorry. It's bound to happen. So they're asking for an increase for classified workers up to $20 an hour for minimum wage. And that's the equivalent of around $41,600 annual salary, which for the Charlotte-Mecklenburg, the Charlotte-Gastonia area, that's a little over half the area median income for a single person in the area.
Ricky Lopes, I think that's how you say his name, is one of the people behind this study, and he told the school board that they discovered that often new employees make more than veteran employees at CMS.
That's going to affect morale. You're working side by side with somebody that's making more money than you, but you have the same experience.
So this would be the first comprehensive pay raise since 2007. That's almost two decades ago. And it would increase the pay for about 5,000 employees, including those not currently making $20 an hour. What do these workers do? Who are these workers?
Yeah, so the classified workers, let's see, this is including technicians, custodians, and bus monitors and other assistants and coordinators are kind of in this bucket of classified workers. I feel like this story is a really good reminder that these pay raises kind of come from the ground up. People have been asking for these for a while. This is something that has, you know, employers have been reporting as like the number one concern from employees for quite some time.
And administrators are suggesting rolling this out in phases. The money for phase one is already in the Mecklenburg County budget, but does that mean it's in the school board's budget?
I guess not necessarily. So I guess the board will be voting on this proposal on the 28th, and I guess we'll see from there.
So it's a good thing you're on our program today, Zach, because you're the climate person, and we continue to watch these fires proliferating in Los Angeles and Californians struggling to get control of these massive fire systems that have decimated major portions of L.A. But those fires are not necessarily exclusive to the West Coast or to particularly hot and dry areas like California. State officials here are now warning about a high risk for wildfires across our state this week. Why?
So a couple of different reasons here, Mike. If you pull up the fire risk map, this is something through the state climate office, you can see that eastern North Carolina, you're seeing very high and high risk of fire. And this matches up pretty closely with our drought maps. We're seeing areas that are very dry. This is going to be, they're going to be a little bit more prone to wildfires. But at the same time, where it doesn't really match up is where you look at western North Carolina. And part of this is due to the amount of fuel left behind from Hurricane Helene. You had Hurricane Helene knock down a bunch of trees, and this creates a lot of, you know, potential kindling for a fire to start.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, so surprisingly, we are in that fire warning area on that map, Charlotte.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was checking last night to see if there were any fires, active fires in North Carolina. There's one that was a small fire somewhat near here and another one on the east. But there's nothing over an acre right now that's active as far as I could see. So we have this fire risk at the moment, but no real large active fires.
And that risk map pretty much blankets the state. I mean, there are little pockets that are not covered by this, but we're in smack dab in the middle of it all. What are they advising? Just be aware that this could happen and be ready to report it. What are they telling us to do or not do?
I think it's going to be, yeah, at the same time, anytime you have a higher wildfire risk, you're going to want to be careful about, you know, managing, not doing some burns of like yard waste and things like that. Some of your like normal precautions that you would take to reduce the chance of spreading a fire. Being careful when you go out camping, if anyone's braving the cold weather this month, maybe, you know, keep that bucket of water really close and make sure that you properly douse that fire.
Just want to remind people, if you're planning to camp, the wind chill beginning Monday is going to be about 8 degrees at night, just so you know. If you recall, a lot of members of Charlotte City Council and council staff made a pilgrimage to Munich, Germany, when the Panthers played the Giants and won there last fall. Given our winning ways, who could blame them? Of course, they wanted to go. Council members that we spoke to then, when they returned, said that they wanted to court German business officials, and Councilman Malcolm Graham said it was, quote, an opportunity for the city to really demonstrate its international flair. We were told that council members were going to the game, who were going to the game would have to buy their own tickets, which they did, but no one can answer the basic question, what did all this cost? Well, now we know. Joe, ring the cash register.
A little more than $64,000 for this delegation of 13 people.
Mary, what business was conducted? What did council people do in Germany to court business, to maintain business? Because we have a considerable German coterie of businesses here in the Charlotte area.
Yeah, so this city delegation, alongside a couple reps from Mecklenburg County and the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance, they attended multiple receptions with Munich business leaders and government leaders, held a business recruitment seminar, and also did some meetings with some, especially the city staff who traveled with kind of their counterparts with the city of Munich, sort of comparing ideas on things like transit and affordable housing.
Had this not been paired with the game, the football game, would this have gotten any notice at all? I mean, is it unusual for council members to go and court business that already has a presence here and ask for more in these situations?
I don't think as many people would have went. Certainly city staff may have went, but I think the size of the delegation was significantly larger than we would have seen had the Panthers not been playing in Germany.
And what about
Mary,
the price?
Sorry to cut you off.
That's okay. $64,488.86 is what they came up with for the cost of all of this. And some of that is airfare. And they said before the trip that the city would pay for coach class airfare. Some people's airfare was more than that, which indicates to me they flew business or first. Did we pay for all of that? And is that normal?
Go ahead, Mary.
Yeah, so pretty much everybody was reimbursed for their airfare. Councilmember Tariq Bakari did decline to be reimbursed for his airfare, though the city did pay for his hotel room. And that was the biggest expense for the city. They paid for everyone's hotel stays, ranging from 3 to 6 nights in the city delegation. And according to the names of the hotels on the itinerary provided by the city, they were staying at either a 4-star or 5-star hotel.
And is that normal?
I can't say I see every expense report filed by every city employee or elected official who travels on behalf of the city, but I think it's worth noting that they were staying at 4-star and 5-star accommodations, given a large city like Munich would have other, perhaps more affordable accommodations available as well.
Joe, you have a take on that?
Yeah, they're not going to put city council in, you know, no offense to, you know, some of these budget motels in Germany or a hostel. There were, although that would be
I'd like
a reality
to see it.
Show. I would love to see that. They did pay at least a little more than expected on baggage fees for at least one council member. And one council member did get an upgraded seat because of a medical reason, I was told. And also one interesting thing is the city actually paid $2,900 in tax dollars for a hotel room that had to be canceled. They couldn't get that money refunded. Council member Renee Johnson decided not to go on the trip because of illness.
So they released the spreadsheet that showed you what it cost for the airline travel and for the accommodations, the per diem, ground transportation, et cetera. It didn't look terribly extravagant to me, but what do I know? But given our struggles with transparency with the city, how difficult, if at all, was it to get this information? Joe?
It took a couple of months. I just think with a city delegation of this size for something as prominent as a Panthers game and with how well advertised this trip was, the public had a right to know how much the city spent on this trip. And we know it was $64,000. The city will argue that they got a lot done during this study abroad trip and helped pitch the city on a global stage and can potentially land businesses. As a result, people could also see this as they didn't need to send as many people and the trip seems pointless. Either way, you're going to fall in one of those camps, but the public had a right to know. Draw your own conclusions.
So Michelle Morrow, the unsuccessful Republican candidate to be state superintendent of public instruction, has now founded a nonprofit group to lobby for education issues. What does she say her organization, the National Alliance for Education Reform, will be lobbying for or against? Joe.
Well, her group says that our country is in crisis, our students are suffering, and our future as a constitutional republic hangs in the balance. And her group aims to return our schools to places of safety, academic excellence, patriotism, and moral fortitude. Simply said, this is a group that has been formed as a way to kind of keep her name in the public sphere. You know, a lot of people form groups, organizations like this in between runs for office. So I think we will continue to hear from Ms. Morrow.
In 2 years, North Carolina Senior Senator Republican Tom Tillis will be up for re-election. That race officially began this week. Andy Nilsen threw his hat into the ring. He's a former associate of Richard Burr and Richard Vinroot. He's describes himself as a conservative, but he actually sounds like a moderate. And he's been opposed to Donald Trump on many things. Who is this guy? And is this just the first of many challenges to Tom Tillis? I have 15 seconds.
We'll see. I think he's the first one to test the waters. I think some anti-Tillis Republicans are hoping for a bigger name to jump in.
Late last year, Salisbury Mayor Karen Alexander passed away after stepping back from her duties as mayor there to focus on her health following a cancer diagnosis. And on Monday night, people gathered for a candlelight vigil in her honor in Salisbury. Speakers praised her energy, her optimism, her dedication to the city. And Anthony Davis, president of Livingston College, had much to say about her support of that historically black institution.
However, what we will always remember most about Mayor Karen Alexander will not be limited to bricks, mortar, and designs. What we will remember, what I will remember most of all, was her willingness to show up. And man, did she show up.
Mayor Karen Alexander was 73. And that's all the time we have here today. So I want to thank Zach Turner, our climate reporter at WFAE News, Joe Bruno, reporter for WSOC-TV, Ryan Pitkin, founder and editor of Queen City Nerve, and Mary Ramsey, local accountability reporter, government accountability reporter for The Observer. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.